Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, August 3rd, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or in the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link, in the upper left-hand corner of the page, it'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for 18 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you will see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on it, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, which can serve as a tutorial for how to use this tool and get the most benefits from it. It's especially useful if you happen to be listening through the archives or you do not have access to a support group in your area and or you cannot listen live and call in for support in using the tool. Those audio files are available. And we hope people do that soon and often, primarily because it's been our experience that it improves our quality of life the more we use these tools. And secondarily, it frequently leads people to have comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those you'd like to share with us, please give us a call at 563-999-3581. And once you call that number, if you press 1 on your phone, it will put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. And I'll turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code. And that is always appreciated when people do that because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention with this work is to be of service. And that's just a whole lot easier to do when people call in and say, this is what I'm dealing with, or this is the worksheet I'd like support in doing, and how can we help you? If you let us know, we will do our best to be a service. 563-999-3581. and call that number and press 1, and we can have a conversation. If memory serves correctly, we have now finished Lesson 17, the first read-through. And I was doing some reading over the past few days about Jill Bolte Taylor's book, Whole Brain Living, and I was just really amazed at how many different ways and times I'm seeing the same message coming across from so many different sources. And Jill Bolte Taylor talks about the 90-second rule. And her research indicates that when we have a strong emotional experience, it's happening because we've chosen a thought that's connected to or resonates with that strong emotional experience, and it creates this, what she calls this neurophysiological response in the body, and we get this flood of sensation, neuropeptides, hormones, et cetera, that shift in our energy system, and we feel the impact of it. And what her research indicates is that once we do that, once we choose a thought or value a thought enough that it triggers that strong emotional response, in the next 90 seconds, that strong emotional response will fade away. And it reminds me of what happens when you strike a gong. It starts to vibrate, and it makes a lot of noise. And if you don't keep hitting the gong, it fades away, and the sound dissipates. Well, that's exactly the same kind of thing that Dr. Taylor is talking about in her book, Whole Brain Living. When we choose a thought, when we value a thought, when we pour our mind energy into a thought that's connected to this flood of neuropeptides and this energetic shift that we feel and experience as an intense emotion, especially if it's negative, in order to keep that energy moving in us, we have to keep valuing or resonating that thought. She might use the word triggering that thought. And her work is highlighting the fact that it really isn't necessary to keep doing that, that we can actually learn how to shift the thoughts and essentially mute the gong or stop adding energy to the vibration that generates that strong emotion. And then we have much more control over our physical, mental, and emotional experience. Day to day, moment to moment. So, in her book, she talks about, and what was striking to me is how similar this is to the work we're doing with the reality management worksheet, where we identify the emotion we're feeling, the dynamic in our life that's going on that we're using to generate thoughts and interpretations about ourselves and others, the specific thought that we're pouring the mind energy into, which creates the emotion, the thought that our mind is giving us that says, you know, you need to have this, this, or this happen in order for you to feel better or for this intense negative emotion to go away. And then the process of canceling the goal and asking to be shown something else is basically letting go of the thought that's producing the negative emotion and shifting the focus of our thoughts over to something else that's more open and allowing and allows insight and allows flow and allows wisdom to enter. And in her book, she's talking about the four different characters, and she talks about four different characters that are tied to the higher brain functioning on the left and the higher brain functioning on the right, and the lower brain functioning on the left, and the lower brain functioning on the right. And so she says that the left thinking character number one is the higher brain. It's a serial processor, right? It works with verbal, thinks in language, it thinks in linear past, present to future, and it's analytical. It focuses on details. It seeks differences. It is judgmental. It's punctual. It thinks of you as an individual. It's concise and precise, and it focuses on me as a concept that I'm separate from others. And it's conscious, and it has structure and order to it. Now, on the other side of the brain, the right side of the brain, higher level thinking, is a parallel processor. It's nonverbal. It thinks in pictures rather than language. It thinks experientially rather than in a linear way. It's present moment based rather than past or future based. Instead of using logical, analytical thought, it uses input from the kinesthetic, from the felt bodily senses. Instead of focusing on details, it looks holistically at the big picture. Instead of seeking differences, it looks for similarities. Instead of being judgmental, it's compassionate. Instead of being so rigidly punctual, it is lost in the flow of time. Instead of thinking of itself as an individual, it thinks about the collective. Instead of being so concise and precise, it is flexible and resilient. Instead of being so fixed and rigid, it's open to possibilities. Instead of focusing on me as a concept, it focuses on we, us, the collective. Instead of being so busy with all of its internal calculations, it's available and open to input. Rather than being conscious, it is what they call unconscious. And rather than having all this structure and order, it's fluid and goes with the flow. And that's just at the higher level, from the left to the right. And then there's the lower level of the brain functioning, which has more to do with the emotions, the limbic system, the amygdala. And the left emotional character, she gives it the number two, is constricted, it's rigid, it's cautious, it's fear-based, it's stern and judgmental, it loves only conditionally, it doubts things, it bullies, it is righteous, it manipulates, it believes it's tried and true, and only the things it's already tried and work are true. It's independent, it's selfish, it's critical, it's superior versus inferior, it's right versus wrong, good versus bad thinking. And its corollary on the right side of the brain at the emotional level, at the amygdala, et cetera, it thinks expansively, openly. It's a risk-taking part of the brain. It's fearless rather than fear-based. It's friendly rather than stern. It loves unconditionally rather than conditionally. It trusts rather than doubts. It supports rather than bullies. It's grateful rather than righteous. It goes with the flow rather than manipulating. It's creative and innovative rather than tried and true. It's collective in its approach rather than independent. It's sharing rather than selfish. It's kind rather than critical. It's got equality as its base rather than judgmental, superior versus inferior. And it's contextual rather than these compartmentalizations of good, bad, right, wrong, up, down. So it's more fluid and more able to embrace complexities. And so if you look at this, these four characters of the brain and the way they function, and you combine that with the 90-second rule that says, you know, once I trigger a strong negative emotion, unless I keep triggering it, it's going to dissipate and fade away within 90 seconds. Well, one of the best things to do to get that stepping away from re-triggering the negative emotion is take a breath. What do we teach in here? We teach how to take a breath that will trigger the rest and digest response, that will trigger the parasympathetic response, that will trigger the vagus nerve calming response. So we take a deep breath, I hold it at the top, I hold it for a couple seconds, and I slow the exhale down. And it's like hitting the interrupt button on your emotional reactivity. And it helps bring your mind into the present moment because you're focusing on the breath and you're focusing on what's happening in this very moment. And she recommends that we learn to breathe, recognize, appreciate, inquire, and navigate. So the first one is you take that breath, which hits the pause button on that emotional reactivity, and then we start to recognize which of the four characters in the circuitry are running me in this present moment. Am I rigid and black and white thinking? Am I thinking only of myself or am I thinking of the collective? Am I more in the flow or am I more in the past versus the present or am I in the present moment? So I recognize which of the four characters is active in the moment and then I appreciate whichever character you find yourself exhibiting. Appreciate the fact that you have all four characters available to you at any moment. And it might be good to breathe again here. And then you might inquire within yourself and invite all four characters into the huddle so they can collectively and consciously strategize your next move. And then you might want to breathe again, and now you can navigate with your new reality with all four characters of your mind, of your brain, bringing their best game. And she talks about how to do that a little bit more specifically throughout the book. To my mind, it was just amazing how similar this system is, this recognition of how our mind-body-energy system works is to what we're teaching in our support groups, what we do with the reality management worksheet, what we're talking about here with the Way of Mastery from Lesson 1 on, where it says you are creating your experience of life. And, you know, the stuff that Jill Taylor uses in her books is so hand-in-glove fitting with what we talk about when we say, go listen to the Anil Seth video on how we hallucinate our perception. What our mind, what our brain is doing, what our processor inside our brain is doing, is within the context of the way we've been conditioned in our culture, what the Way of Mastery would call the intellectual level. And our intellect has been just crammed full of trivialities, according to the Way of Mastery. And in that context, all we have access to until we learn something new is what we've been trained to believe and trained to judge and trained to feel. And that has a tremendous momentum for most of us who've been reacting in this way for many years, if not decades. And so what's mine to do if my mind is showing me that I'm under attack and this is life and death and I better pull out all the stops and yell and scream and rage and I'm just going to do what's been programmed into my brain. And if I've been raised in a different system and I've been taught breathing first and love and honor and respect are more important than being right, and if that happened to be what I watched my parents do while I was growing up, that will be what gets resonated in me. But for those of us that weren't that lucky, for those of us who grew up in the Western world and we have this history of training and conditioning and this auto response pattern like a reflex, it's so beneficial to learn how the system works and that we have the capacity to question every conclusion that our mind, our brain might jump to. and we have the capacity to question, okay, which part of my brain is making me breathe rapidly, feeling tension in my muscles, getting ready for a fist fight, but there's nobody around. I just read an email, right? I don't need to get fight or flight ready here because there's no threat to my physical safety. And so I can breathe, I can question, I can push the pause button on that intense negative reactivity of the emotional system. For a while, I might need to come to the PDF file that some of the diagrams that Dr. Taylor makes available in her book and say, okay, I got to come back here and remember which of the four characters is working here. Am I feeling constricted or expansive? Am I feeling trusting or doubting? Am I feeling judgmental or compassionate? Am I thinking with all kinds of language, or am I getting impressions and pictures? And when that's happened and I can identify which part of my brain is resonating with the interpretation I've placed on this life event, on the world unfolding around me, then I can choose again. I can ask to be shown. How do I get all four parts of my brain working at their best level to give me a whole different picture? You know, this is what we do with the reality management worksheet. We cancel the picture that our mind is showing us, and we cancel what the mind is telling us absolutely has to happen in order for us to be safe or happy. And we breathe and ask to be shown. We put ourselves in that open, allowing space where new possibilities bubble up. So this is a process of learning, of exploring, of getting introduced to the different capacities that your very system, the one you were born with, makes possible for you. And you don't have to do that. Yet, if you choose to, it's available for every human. Unless, of course, there's some kind of an organic damage to tissue or the nerve centers themselves, like what would happen to someone in a stroke, the way Dr. Taylor had a stroke and she watched herself recover from it. But during the time that the tissue didn't have enough blood flow to it and or there was excessive blood flooding the brain from this venous malformation that she had, the physiological part of her energy system wouldn't let her brain function the way it does when everything's connected and flowing. But the wonderful news is we can learn and grow. We have capacities for all four levels of the character that she's outlined here. Every one of us has the capacity to be more open and flowing, more flexible. Every one of us has the capacity to let ourselves see impressions, feel impressions, rather than cling to the rigidity of language and categorization and left, right, up, down. You know, it's not just right or wrong. There are all kinds of shades of nuance going on in our lives. And in order for us to get access to them and use the input from those levels of nuance, we have to be willing to step out of the rapid flood into the negative emotional state, and we have to learn to do something differently. It's what the Way of Mastery is saying here in the Way of Transformation. Transformation requires that I learn to use my time differently, that I learn to process my experiences differently, that I learn to take responsibility more and more, moving toward that 100% responsibility for everything I experience. Not everything that happens in my life, yet everything I experience based on my interpretation of and my response to the life events, the flow of creative energy, the movement of people in and out of my life, the choices the people around me make, how all of that impacts me is my creation. I have just many people lately, and it's kind of a flood in my caseload recently of people who are experiencing waves and lots of waves of intense emotion. And Dr. Taylor says in her book, she says, you know, so people are asking me, how did I experience this bliss state? What do they need to do to experience the bliss state that I moved into when my stroke hit? What behaviors, what meditations, what process of meditation, if I use meditation, what drugs do I need to take to move out of the negative emotional state into the bliss state? And she says that's been particularly more poignant lately because people are using psychedelics for microdosing of psychedelics for brain hacking to improve day-to-day functioning, and they're using psychedelics in conjunction with therapy to treat things like post-traumatic stress. And she says, that's not my area of expertise, working with the drugs. But she does offer something very similar to what the Reality Management Worksheet offers. Figure out which part of your brain is functioning, what thoughts it's serving up, what pattern it's thinking in, and then take a step back and take another breath and ask, what are the other parts of your brain able to offer? What's another way you can look at this situation? What's another way to process the input that your eyes and your ears and your felt senses are giving you, so that you might reach a separate, hopefully very divergent conclusion from the ones that have you feeding and fueling all the negative emotional states. So our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And we've got at least a half an hour left to take comments or questions. How is this landing? How does it feel to you to talk about the overlap between this work and Guy Finley's work? Guy Finley last night was... we were listening to him in the support group, and he was doing a talk from earlier in July, I believe. And his theme is the hero's journey, the same way Dr. Campbell would talk about, Joseph Campbell would talk about every one of us is on its own, his or her own hero's journey. We start at the center. We need to grow and move out and expand. We need to have different experiences. We work to integrate what we learn. We fight through difficulties. We try to reach goals that we set or someone else sets for us. We meet new people, we get introduced to different aspects of ourselves and the world around us, and then we bring that knowledge, that success, that transformation of ourselves back to our home, whether it's our home inside of ourselves individually or our home geographically where we were raised, and we offer that to the various parts of ourselves and or to our friends and family And that's the hero's journey. And Guy Finley is doing a series of talks for Talks in the Pines for this year where that's his theme. And I've hit that, the talk about and the talks about the hero's journey and the process of us learning and growing and evolving or maturing in two other places. So it's now four places in my life in the past month where that's the theme that people are using. And these are not people that are all reading the same material. They might read the same source material, but they're not reading each other. So it's not like Guy Finley's reading The Way of Mastery or Michael Rice is reading The Way of Mastery. Or Jill Bolte Taylor is reading Dr. Michael Rice's work. But as I was fascinating, as I was reading through the list of the four characters from Jill Taylor's work, that she's got that there are parts of our brain that look for differences and parts that look for similarities. And that's one of the things I've talked about frequently on the internet show and in support groups is what I find so much more beneficial is to seek similarities, to look for the similarities between The Impersonal Life by Joseph S. Benner and A Course in Miracles and The Way of Mastery and Guy Finley's work and Michael Rice's work, rather than engage in the turf war of saying, I'm going to see the differences. I'm going to tell you how different Michael Rice's work is from Way of Mastery. And then, of course, if they're so dramatically different, then we have to figure out, okay, which one's right and which one's wrong. We have to be judgmental and or dichotomous. There's only one that can be right, and the other one must be wrong by extension. And here, you know, we've talked about that, and I've talked about that in great detail. Some people are probably tired of hearing me talk about looking for the similarities across these various books and teachers and wisdom schools. Because I talk about that because that's been the most beneficial to me. That yields huge benefits. And here in Jill Bolte Taylor's work, it's one of the primary distinctions between the left-thinking character and the right-thinking character, character one as she labels it and character four as she labels it. And one of those differences is the left-thinking character focuses on details, seeks differences, and is judgmental. And the right-thinking character looks holistically at the bigger picture, seeks similarities, and is compassionate. So the synchronicity, the overlap of the way these teachings and wisdom schools are fitting together is really becoming apparent for me, really resonating deeply with me, and I'm curious how it's landing for you. If you're finding other work you're doing, reading or listening to that has similarities to or has significant overlaps with either the way of Mastery, The Course in Miracles, the Guy Finley work, what we're talking about here on Mind Shifters Radio with The Way of Mastery, or something else that you're finding resonates with you or is being of use to you. So again, the call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, I will see the little hand go up and I will turn on your microphone. How is this resonating for you? What are you noticing or responding to? Area code 760, you're in the air. Let's try it again. Wait for the spinning wheel to change. 760, is this Ann?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Welcome, Ann.
I missed the first little bit. Are you quoting from her Insight book, Book of Insight book?
No, this is the book about whole brain living. It's a more recent book. And the title Whole Brain Living, and the subtitle is The Anatomy of Choice and the Four Characters That Drive Our Life.
Oh, okay. I caught when you were just starting on the fourth character. Can I reread? I mean, I've got stuff all underlined in her other book, but that's cool. I really like that that's available. Okay, The Whole Brain. I'll write that down. I started listening just as you were talking about the fourth character and then the breathing, and I need to remember that as I'm going through reduced symptoms from COVID. I tested COVID positive on Monday night. I'm following a protocol, a hybrid CR protocol, and my daughter's, you know, reminded me of stuff, and I already called into my doctor. I was responsible for my immune system reduction. So I thought I was doing better about being codependent and helping this friend. She has beginning dementia. The MRI report is like mild something, something, you know, these big terms. But, and I went to the doctor with her that time that the doctor gave it. Anyway, doesn't matter at this point. She's, thankfully, gratefully, one of her granddaughters was able to come down and stay with her now. And I realized that I was talking to her yesterday. Well, for the first call, I think she intended to call me. Later in the day, she didn't even know she called me. There's stuff going on with her. However, she had been given a memory, I don't remember what it was, but a memory med, and she wasn't taking it anymore because she said it made her throw up, but she never told the doctor that. And I didn't realize that when we went to meet with the doctor, I would have brought it up. And then she was supposed to have been taking this other kidney thing. And then, anyway, those are all details you don't need to know. I know what I realized I was doing, but I couldn't leave somebody, you know, with the dog pooping in the house in the middle of the night or in the morning, you know, for 6 days. I cleaned up poop for 6 days out of seven. And finally, when the granddaughter came, she realized, okay, the dog has got to go, but she's got a toddler too. And this is in a trailer that's like only 10 by 30 or whatever. It's one of those single wide with just one bedroom. So when I got the self-test and did those Monday night, it's like, okay, my prayer was, all right, whatever it is, I just need to deal with it. And when you talk about breathing, it's not like I don't know to do the breathing, but there's something that when you hear somebody else say it, it just triggers that, oh, yeah. So when I start to cough, which everything is reduced, my fever is normal today, and I know I need to that way for 24 hours, or it needs to stay that way. I can't keep it for 24 hours. But the breath, I agree. It's like, okay, so when I started to cough a little bit ago while I was listening to this, I just took another breath again, which, of course, started to make me cough again. And go, okay, take another breath. And I'm just going right with you. I mean, and it's like, okay, the body just says thank you. but that is fascinating. And would you give me the title of her book again? Whole Brain?
Yes, WHOLE, Whole Brain Living.
Okay.
Jill Bolte Taylor, BOLTE Taylor.
Whole Brain. Yeah, I have her. I went over and looked to make sure I was looking at the same name and, yeah, my book. Because in the Insight book, she talks about the different parts of the brain really well. But I like that she, you know, went and did something else because I kind of was hoping something, you know, would come out of that first book. So that's awesome. Anyway, my energy is slowly improving, but I need to remember for myself to just rest. And it's hard for me to stop doing things, just you know, moving. I mean, I know I need to move more, but not where I have to think, I guess I want to say. Anyway, I'm just waiting for the symptoms to subside totally.
Well,
but
breath work is good. EFT tapping is good. Worksheets are good. Lots of good clean water is good. Yep. Well, I'm glad to hear that you're doing all of the above, and that you already know about Dr. Taylor's work, and now that you can expand that as your energy comes back, maybe you'll find some value in the book Whole Brain Living.
Yes, definitely.
And if you're like me, you'll start looking for the similarities between that and Michael's work and or any other work that you do, because it's when I see these similarities and these overlaps that it sinks in deeper and I get it quicker. It integrates
better.
I agree.
For me. I think that's what I started seeing, which is why way back I'd asked if you could interview her, because I started to see the similarities in the first book. Because in the
I have a request out, and I have somebody that had her at their speaking engagement who is, I've made the request that they make the introduction so that she might consider doing this little interview, since we don't have, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of followers, but that's what it takes. We need somebody who knows and can do the introduction, and
cool.
If it happens, it'll be delightful. But in the meantime, we can still get access to what she's learned from her work and integrate it for ourselves with Michael's work and others.
Yes, yeah, agreed. Thank you for pursuing that. And thank you. I realized that no matter what society is saying about any kind of disease or virus, if that's not what my body says, then I don't have to believe them. And I think over the years, the training was, oh, wait, you got to go do this or that, or, you know, be on this side or that side. And I'm learning to just do what works for me and then share it, but from my perspective with others. So I thank you for your work, and I'm glad I got to turn it on today so I could hear all this stuff going on. Thank you.
You're very
blessings.
Welcome and deserving. All right. Blessings. Thanks for the call. And technology is doing some weird things. We still have about 15 minutes left if anybody else has questions or comments. This is looking for the ways things are similar and how it's benefiting me. Area code 541, you're in the air.
Yes, Celinda here.
Welcome, Celinda.
And I want to affirm and support what Anne says that she is now discovering that she's just going to go within and listen to what her inner knowing is telling her to do. I've spent all of my life chasing outer authorities, and now I am also doing the very same thing. So we can make a good team together, Anne and I. And I want to thank you for saying what you said all this morning, because that's exactly what I'm finding, that the more I go along, it doesn't matter what I'm reading. I'm looking for the similarities. If there are no similarities, I just drop it and say, you know, I can't find them. It doesn't mean they're not there, but it's not speaking to me at this moment. But now I am jumping from the differences to the similarities and now realizing language is very powerful and very meaningful because of the context that it shares with the cultural perspective. It is a reflection of the cultural perspective. So I am now being able to honor those differences and look for the similarities, and I'm just finding the Aramaic gospel expressing in different forms all over the globe, from the Tao Te Ching to the Buddhist philosophy to the Hindu philosophy to the indigenous peoples. It's just everything I pick up now is saying, don't hang on to your rigid concepts about how things should be. Let it go and let life teach you. Everybody has a message and everybody is a teacher and a student, including you, including myself. When I say you, I'm speaking to myself. Yeah, so I just wanted to thank you. That was such a wonderful affirmation of my journey at the moment, and I so appreciate the perspective that you're sharing. It's like I'm allowing myself to flourish, and then once in a while, or often, not necessarily just once in a while, depends on context, someone will come along, and it'll be like there'll be an inner knowing, an inner consensus between us, and we just let the language flow the way it can flow. And we, yeah, I think finding common ground is so important.
All right. Any other thoughts for you?
No, what was that fourth aspect you said it was that you gave? Oh, let me find my page again so I can find it.
Well, she's listing four characters that she says are in the brain, right?
Well,
and she's
saying that
there are two at the higher level, on one on the left and one on the right. And she, so the higher brain thinking on the left side she calls character one. The higher brain thinking on the right side she calls character four. And then on the lower brain, down near the brain stem, the amygdala, et cetera, there's, on the left side, it's the emotional brain, and that's character two. And on the right side, there's the emotional brain, that's character three.
Yes, I got that. It was that breathe, recognize, appreciate, and what was the last word on that section that you were talking about in her book.
So read, recognize, breathe, recognize, appreciate, inquire within, and invite all four characters to the huddle, so to speak, so that they can collectively give you input. You can tap into all four aspects of what your brain processing can do. And the last one is navigate your new reality with all four characters bringing their best game.
Very good.
So the first thing is I interrupt the process. I stop banging the gong. I take a breath. I soothe and calm. I step back and watch without holding a thought that you know, pouring a lot of mind energy into a thought, which is basically just going to hit the gong and send out more vibrations of this intense emotional field. And as I do that and I get a breath and the intensity subsides, then I can ask myself and recognize which of the four characters in the circuitry are running that intense emotion in the present moment. And then I can appreciate that whichever character you find yourself exhibiting is valuable, has its own input. I can appreciate the fact that I have four characters available to me at any moment. And so I can inquire, okay, what do the other three characters have to say? How can I invite them in and inquire about what they have to say, and then use all of that input to do the last step, which is to navigate my present moment experience with the input of all four aspects of my brain online at the time.
Yeah, I call the fourth stage, inquire stage, my inner Middle East town meeting.
Okay. Call it what you will.
I know, that's a mouthful.
It's trying to, you know, it's asking to be shown. you know, that's the different inputs from your own, in Jill's work, it's the different inputs from the various aspects of your brain functioning.
Right, those four aspects, yeah. And that reminds me also of forebrain and hindbrain, Dr. Tim. Yeah, which education of kinesiology worked a lot with that, forebrain, hindbrain integration, yeah. Cool beans. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. I'll mute you so you can listen to the rest of the show and the second hour coming up in about 8 or 9 minutes. Blessings. So we've got about 8 or 9 minutes left. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we'd love to hear your comments and your questions, your 2 cents. In the book, Whole Brain Living, if you get the Audible, there's a PDF file in the book. It actually comes printed in the book. But Dr. Taylor talks about a series of questions you can ask and tune into to get to recognize character 1 and character 2, character 3 and character 4, as she calls them, as different aspects of what your brain does in its functioning. And it does it automatically. It does it reflexively. It's, you know, her take on it would be that it evolved to function that way. And, you know, to my way of thinking, that PDF that maps them out and gives these series of questions you can ask so that you can get to know more about what does character 1 brain thinking feel like? What does it look like? What does character 2 brain thinking feel like and look like? To my way of thinking, these are almost exactly analogous to what the way of mastery is giving us in terms of exercises. It's slowing down, it's inquiring within, it's getting curious about our own internal functioning and building from there, building awareness, building skills, building different response patterns, which if we develop a different response pattern and we are doing enough analysis so that we say, oh, I like the consequences of that response pattern better, then we can choose to do that response pattern more often. And if it's one that we really like the benefits of, the consequences of, we might choose to do it so frequently that it becomes a habit. And if we strengthen that habit because we really like the consequences of it, it might eventually become the default habit. And by the time that happens, we are going to have a very different experience of ourselves and our relationships and our life. And to my way of thinking, then the book has served its purpose, which is to simply usher us into a different level of experience of our lives and our relationships with others. We are creating our experience of life, and most of us are creating without knowing that we're creating it. So at the first level of awakening or opening with the way of mastery is to introduce us to the fact that we have the possibility to move from this unconscious co-creating pattern to a conscious co-creating pattern. We can consciously direct the flow of our thoughts. We can recognize that when we pour enough energy into this particular thought, it's like hitting a gong in this direction at this strength with this kind of a mallet. And it produces a very different sound than if I hit the gong very gently with a softer mallet on a different part of the gong. And so recognizing what I'm doing with my thoughts to create my emotions is one of the first steps on being able to create a different pattern in my emotional life. And of course, the series of exercises that we've been introduced to with the Way of Mastery just expands that and expands it and expands it. And that's what several people are doing. Guy Finley talks about he's got exercises near the end of almost every talk, and Michael Rice has his worksheets and his targeted journaling that he calls the Mind Shifter tool, and he's got the commitment tool, and he's got the Mind Goal Management worksheet, and he's got the Laws of Living worksheet and the Tree of Life worksheet and the Codependence to Interdependence worksheet. All of these tools, to my way of thinking, are doing the same thing. They're giving me the chance to introduce myself to different aspects of my own thought process. And the more I learn about it, the more different ways that I become aware that I can change that particular thought process. So it becomes something that that it yields results that I prefer. Like I quote this often. I say Mike Dooley sends out these, you know, notes from the universe, and he says thoughts become things. So choose the good thoughts, and then you'll have good things in your life. Right? Thoughts become things, so choose the good ones. We are actively creating our experience of life. And once we become aware of that and we get to study some of the actual dynamics of the process, we are more informed, we're more empowered, and then, you know, before you know it, the sky's the limit, which is one of Wayne Dyer's books from early on. I think it was his third book. Anyway, we appreciate your being here. We'll see what happens tomorrow, whether we dive into Lesson 18 or we go back and review Lesson 17 based on the flow. And we're encouraging people to build the habit of monitoring your internal experience for the earliest warning signs of upset, and take a breath at the earliest warning signs of upset. Turn the focus inside and ask yourself, how am I creating this emotion? What's the thought I've decided to pour my mind energy into that's making the sound of this gong vibrate through me, emotionally speaking? And how can I shift my mind energy away from that? How can I cancel the goals, the cravings, the needs my brain tells me I have to have? Take my mind energy away from that so that within 90 seconds or so, that intense negative emotion will fade. And I can choose again. I can shift the focus to something more positive and build in that positive direction. It's a life-changing process. It doesn't require any apparatus or drugs. It simply requires your willingness. It requires your conscious awareness of what you're doing with your thought. And it is a revelation that pays huge dividends. So hopefully in the near future, Jeannie and or Michael will be on to do the second hour. I'll remind us all that tomorrow's a Thursday, so we'll have another support group tomorrow night. All the information you would need to join us there is available at mindshiftersacademy.org. And I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tian. Appreciate you.
You're very welcome and deserving. Have a wonderful show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. And today is Wednesday, August the 3rd, 2022. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts up a hand and lets us know that you want to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. We'll give Michael just a moment to get dialed in. And, honey, hold on. Okay. Excuse me just a moment while I get contraption turned on for the little girl here. And so Michael will dial in just a moment. I'll invite you to go to our website, which is whyagain.org, and look around. Test out the different worksheets. There's also audios and videos that you can watch and listen to. And you can download the book for free and click on the Start Here button or the Bullseye. And those will both take you to the page where you can go to all of the posters, to the worksheets for every workshop, not just the reality management worksheet. And just scroll around and see what you can find and let us know if there's something that's not working or something that you would like for me to move it somewhere else where it's easier to find. Drop me a line at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org, and I'll be glad to see what I can do for you. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Delighted that you're here. And then we get to entertain this, probably not really a good word, to experience and understand something that goes outside of the normal mindset of the culture and return to the kind of mindset that we're really capable of as human beings. And to recognize that the primo technology of the mind on planet Earth appeared and disappeared about 2,000 years ago. And when you go back to the original Aramaic language and you start to comprehend that technology and what's possible, it just makes for such a change in the world. There's a British physicist who said this: the stream of knowledge is heading toward a non-mechanical reality. You know, we've been taught we live in a mechanical world. Everything's mechanized. It's like a giant machine. But here's what James Jeans, physicist, says: the universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a machine. Mind no longer appears to be an accidental intruder into the realm of matter. We ought rather hail it as the creator and governor of the realm of matter. Profound, profound piece of information. And if you look 2,000 years ago in the opening words in the book of John, of course, the Greeks translated those words from a mechanical mind that was looking for someone to, what should I say, someone to run their lives for them. And we're told that by the Greeks that it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh. And that Word is equated with a man named Yeshua by so many. But if you go to the Aramaic, that's totally and completely out in left field. The opening words in the book of John, very much closer to what James Jean just saying, says, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. That we live in a world organized, as Jean says, we ought rather hail my mind as creator and governor of the realm of matter. When you go back to that Aramaic 2,000 years ago, they understood exactly what was happening. Mind energy becomes flesh. And when our minds are tricked into thinking in ways of error, our ways of error seem to prove themselves out because we look and we go, see, that's the way it works. But it isn't working that way because that's the way it works. It's working that way because of the way our mind interacts with this world of so-called matter. Now, if we listen to Einstein, Einstein says matter doesn't exist. Einstein says, quote, on such things as matter, we have been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy. Energy whose vibrations have been so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses, there is no matter. So Einstein is telling us that matter does not exist. We live in a world of energy. Now, you look at some of the errors that we've made. For instance, you think about a child. A child starts out, you know, a baby's born, weighs 6 pounds, and 20 years later, the child weighs 180 pounds and is 6'2". Now, in all of your thinking, would you ever say that the child is 6'2" and weighs 180 pounds because of time? Would you put the onus, would you put the responsibility for that on time? Would be ridiculous. The child, yes, well, it happened over a period of 20 years, but it happened because cells divide and grow when there's nourishment, and we see the unfolding of the mind energy program that is held within the structure of that particular form. But isn't it interesting? And we don't blame time for growth, but we blame time for diseases. Oh, he's that old, she's that old, they're just getting sickly because they're old. And we've been given a thought, and, you know, this is coming via the way of a warning to be careful what you let yourself buy into, because through the way you think, you literally set the world of so-called matter into a pattern, into a way of functioning. So one does not get sick because time went by, because they're 60 or 70 or 80 or 90 or 200 years old. In fact, there's some interesting research that says that the most productive period in people's lives is between the age of 60 and 70. And then they're saying that the next most productive is between 70 and 80. And yet so many people dread being old because the world has blamed aging, what we call aging, on time. And it doesn't have anything to do with time. In exactly the same way as we go, well, you know, that body that started, or so-called body, that energy field that started out at 6 pounds and 20 years later was 190 and was 6'2", we understand how that unfolding happened. And we never stopped, or at least we're inviting you to stop and question. So often, it's never questioned. Well, we've been told from the beginning. In fact, you know, a child is 3, and what do people say? How old is that child? How huge a mistake. If the mind has the power that James Jean says it has, and it offers in the ancient Aramaic scriptures, if the mind has that kind of power, how huge a mistake is it to respond to the child is 3 years old? What are we structuring our bodies for when we buy into the idea that age is the toxin, that age is the cause of what happens, rather than understanding that the cells unfold according to a pattern, and if the pattern includes the mind energy that age is toxic and will kill you, time will kill you. In fact, I've heard medical researchers say that. When time has nothing to do with the process. You remember the quote we've used several times over the years from the De Courcy Clinic in Cincinnati, a research facility that back, oh, it's probably close to 40 years ago that I first heard this quote at a medical conference. And here's what the De Courcy Clinic concluded. Quote, time is not toxic. Time has no effect on human tissue under any conditions. It is the belief in the effects of time by those who subscribe to such a belief that acts as a poison. So what kind of error have we allowed ourselves to buy into, and by so doing, directed matter to become in the likeness of the errant thoughts we think? And so to step in and begin to forgive those errant thoughts, to allow this energy structure, which, you know, when we get down to the bottom line in physics, energy is eternal. Your physiology is energy. It must be eternal. And the only reason it isn't is because we've been trained to kill it with our minds. To talk about how old it's going to get, how decrepit it's going to get, how it's going to fall apart. And even if we've never said those words, we've had the visual given to us over and over and over. Oh, that old man. See how that old woman is all stooped over, implying that age is the enemy, that time is the toxin. So the invitation here is to forgive your belief in the effects of time and everything else. Remember our definition of denial. Whenever I think or speak as though something outside of me is the cause of something that's happening inside of me. Now, something out there through resonance can cause motion within us if we hold a matching energy to what's out there. But it is not the cause of what it is that's moving in us. And if we discover that there is an untoward energy moving in us, if we've chosen to develop the skill, then we can apply forgiveness to that energy and literally move it or remove it from our structures. That's the whole bottom line of what this process that we're speaking about of forgiveness is about. What is it in you? If you look at any arena in your life, if James Jeans is correct that we ought to be acknowledging the mind as the mover and, let's see, what were his words? Hail it as the creator and governor of the realm of matter. What mind energy would you benefit from looking at in your life, owning and removing from your structure? What kind of thoughts have been modeled in your world? Perhaps a part of the good old family system that you came from or the cultural system that you come from. What kind of thoughts need to be forgiven in order that errant influences do not unfold because of that error in thinking? And to recognize the profound, just deeply profound power of understanding that forgiveness is what you can use to remove from your structure mind energy that does not and never did belong within your structure, and in so doing, removing the effects of that mind energy and developing a relationship with that power that lies within you that has the ability to go beyond your intellectual prowess. And literally, you know, if we look at the definition of the words in Aramaic, Ruka Dekutcha, feminine elemental force in us, that when invited into activity undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. To develop a relationship with that power that can reach much deeper into the energy system than at this point most of us can penetrate with our mental awareness. And literally, when inviting that power in and turning it over, undoing the effects, undoing things down to depth right into our genes and right throughout the universe, that there is a power that resides in us that when we partnership with it, when we invite it into activity, has the ability to bring change beyond our wildest imagination. And it's not about a disembodied spirit being, as the Greeks translated it. Those words, Ruka Dekutcha, were translated by the Greeks as the Holy Spirit, but there's nothing about a disembodied spirit being there. Ruka is speaking of an elemental force, and Dikudcha is, it comes from the same root as the word kosher in Hebrew, which means that which is proper. You know, kosher isn't some kind of mystical religious idea. They're, what they're saying is we've discovered some things that are proper for the human form. They're things that work in supporting the human form in its function. And then they're coming out of the Aramaic is this understanding that this elemental force in us is feminine and will bend to our wishes, is there to support whatever it is we choose to direct it to do. And if we're directing it in the direction of disease and suffering and pain and blame and what's wrong in my life is all everybody else's fault, then that power has no option but to comply. It's a purely executive force. It is a purely executes whatever commands are given. You know, you give your computer a direction to execute 2 + 2. Now, if the computer's been improperly programmed and it's been programmed that 2 + 2 = 5, the computer doesn't think or have a choice or say, oh, no, you don't want this answer. It simply spits up whatever answer's there. So if improperly structured, the computer executes the command as it's given, which leads to one of the biggest challenges in the computer world, and that is that those darn things do what you tell them to do, not what you want them to do. Person who develops a computer that does what you want it to do rather than what you tell it to do, you'll notice that most of the times you've had a problem with your computer, it's been human error. It's been giving commands that couldn't be executed properly, because that's not what the computer was designed to do, and so it simply did what you told it to do. And so there's this executive power in us that executes what it is we ask for. It's referred to many times in the ancient teachings, ask and you receive, seek and you will find, knock it will be opened, all kinds of ways that we were told that this power that runs throughout the universe that has the ability to reach into every corner of your universe and bring about the results you ask for is there for you. And it does not determine whether or not what it's asked to execute is good for you or not. If you put in, oh, when I get to be X number of years of age, then I'll get this kind of decrepit or that kind of decrepit or this or that, you know, it doesn't say, hey, you know, you don't have to do that. Its function is simply to take what it's given and bring it into expression in the world. And it would seem, if we have the ability to listen beyond our own minds, if we look at the progression of our world, it looks like there's something that's continuously building deeper and deeper, more complex physiological expression of something that already exists in a level beyond the physical. Now, if you don't believe that one, read the book The Secret Life of Plants by Cleve Baxter. Cleve was a lie detector operator who one day decided that he wanted to see what would happen. You know, part of a lie detector test is a galvanic skin response, which basically measures the resistance to an electric current of skin. And if people sweat and the skin becomes moist, it conducts more current. And people who lie tend to sweat. And so the galvanic skin response goes down when somebody lies. That's one of the ways that a lie detector operates. But Cleve got this bright idea one day. He had a plant that was looking kind of dry, and he wondered how long it would take for the moisture to get to the leaves when he watered it. So he hooked his plant up to his lie detector and poured water into the soil around it And instead of getting the response he thought he would, the response he got was what he would equate to a human being under stress giving a sigh of relief. So he's got this plant. He hooks the electrodes to the plant, gives it water, and the plant goes, whew, sigh of relief. What is behind that physiological expression? And is it possible that there is much, much, much more waiting to come through into physical expression if we were to tune into and make room for that and bring it into physical expression? Instead of being mesmerized with what's already happening in the world. So I just invite you to look at what is it in your life, what is it in your that you come to believe that maybe isn't true, that maybe doesn't stand up to the standard of truth? And what level of skill do you have at removing the directives that are pushing your life, maybe your relationships, family relationships, business relationships, that are pushing your finances or whatever area of your life in a direction that simply replicates something from the past rather than reflects a fresh, new creative process, a fresh, new possibility, not stuck in patterns of generations and generations who believed a certain way? You look at that story about the Jews wandering in the desert for 40 years, and you realize, if you really look at that story, that they weren't talking about a hot, sandy place. It's silly to think that people who understand astronomy could be lost in a 35-square-mile area for 40 years. That would just be ludicrous. But you realize that word desert represents the unconscious. And that, yes, most people live for 40 or so years before they start to scratch their heads and go, maybe there's something going on other than what I've been taught to believe, i.e. that everybody else is at fault for what's happening in my life. And maybe as I take responsibility and begin to change what's happening in me, my physiology will change, instrument will change, my whole creative process will change because I changed my mind. And then recognizing the power of that technology that has been hidden for so long that we're working to bring back, and that is the technology of being able to drop into one's own unconscious dynamics and remove causes that are there for things that do not need to unfold, but perhaps have unfolded simply because they're there. You know, you look at that story, you listen to the solution to that story in the Old Testament about the Jews wandering in the desert, and you hear them say that the resolution came, the way to get out of the desert into what they called the Promised Land, which is nothing more than the ability to consciously originate mind energy and create your life, said what had to happen was the old generation had to die off. And that doesn't mean everybody in old physical bodies. The root of the word generation is genari, which means cause. All of the causes held in the mind had to be removed in order to make room for a new creation to occur. And when you hear that speaking about a new creation and listen to that phrase, a new creation in Christ, what are they talking about? There is a mind of love in you, which is what the mind of Christ was called. And they spoke about how, and that's not a religious idea, it's simply the mind of love that can operate in you. And that when you're operating in that, you've got a whole new creation happening. But when you fall into the rote principles of carbon-based memory in the past, then you end up being stuck in the past, locked in the desert, wishing and hoping for something, but finding that accumulated mind energy of 1,000 generations of error has a stronger grip on what happens in the world than the fleeting thoughts of power that go through your mind. And when you realize that there's a work to be done to undo the grip that 1,000 generations of insane creative happening is faced and is processed out and is undone is really an important piece in the process. And that, you know, promised land is not some nice paradise kind of place. It's the place where we are consciously aware of what it is we're creating and how it is that we create. And it simply brings our creations, the ones we consciously, purposely engage in, about in our lives. Is that the kind of power we've been given? My offering is yes. And so it becomes a dual process, that of becoming more and more conscious of your ability to originate as opposed to execute. Remember, the executive power in you that executes, carries it out. There's a power in you that can reach through all the universe and pick out energies as needed and bring them about for your expression. The job we have is to develop the ability to bring about a fresh, originative faculty that allows us to originate the highest levels of mind energy for a human being and bring them about in our world, individually and collectively. And so in a nutshell, that's kind of where this work is heading and what we're all about. And we're delighted that you're here to be part of the conversation. Ms. Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
No, it is all quiet. So no hands up. So if someone presses once, our number again is 563-999-3581 and press 1.
Just one second here.
Michael Petty. So press 1. We'd love to hear from you. While we're waiting, we'll
and Jeannie
hear,
was.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say
a couple hands go up.
Oh, okay. Well, let's go for it.
All right. The first one is area code 770. I think this is Michael. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, folks.
And our apologies for the open mic there, Michael. I'm rocking. How about you? How'd your treatment go yesterday?
Oh, very nice. Very nice.
Awesome.
I'll tell you about that sometime. Very interesting. I think you'd be interested in hearing about this man. So we'll have to connect on that.
Awesome.
Certainly.
Cool. Well, what else is on
what
your
happened.
Mind today? What's?
Yeah, I don't know what happened on this end. All of a sudden, y'all went blank there just before I came on. So just sharing that. I'm not sure what happened, but here we are.
Yeah, Jeannie was just transferring a message to me.
I got you. Really enjoying this information on the languages and so forth. And I'd like to continue where we were a few days ago, but now another question's popped in as you were explaining about the folks in the desert for 40 years, which we're told were Hebrew people. Is that correct?
Theoretically, at least, yes. That's the tradition it comes out of, yes.
I'm thinking that's what the teaching I understood, and they spoke the Jewish language or Hebrew language. I'm kind of confused what the terminology is there.
Okay.
What's your take?
If you talk to anybody who's Hebrew, Jewish tradition, you know, their religious leaders and such, they'll tell you that all of their wisdom keepers spoke Aramaic way back. Oh, this goes back. Jeannie, how long has it been? 15, 17 years or so ago, there was a man who'd done quite a bit of work with our work, and he was Jewish, and he asked his rabbi to have us come and speak at their temple. And he was like, well, this guy, you know, he's Christian, so I'm not so sure that that really works, but he invited me to his home. This guy was about 6'7". He invited me to his home, and, you know, he sat down and he poured us some tea and he started to talk. And I mentioned the fact that, you know, my studies and my work had been with the Aramaic, and that everything that I presented was from the ancient Aramaic language and culture. Well, this guy stood up. I mean, you know, he's huge. And he comes over and he reaches his arms out and he puts them around. He says, let me give you, and I'd never had one of these before, a schnuzzle. He gives me a big hug. He says, yes, come and speak at our synagogue. I only have one request of you. He said, you know, everything that you're saying, bring it, teach it. Just don't use the word Christ or I'll get kicked out of my congregation. People were so offended by that. But the thing that instantly had him say, yes, come and speak, was all of our wisdom keepers spoke Aramaic. They thought in Aramaic. Hebrew is a daughter language. Arabic is a daughter language of Aramaic. If you go back to the Old and New Testament, those books were written in Aramaic. If you go to the Quran was written in Aramaic.
Wow.
And those things were disappeared.
I know how you had touched on the five major religions with the roots back to the Aramaic. And as you were speaking, I didn't have time to, of course, to do any research, but I was thinking, well, how did we get from Aramaic into Hebrew, Jewish, and then and so forth? It kind of just each language, I am surmising at this point, got further and further away from the truths of the Aramaic.
Well, as I said, you know, when we talked about this last time, there was a bishop named Rabbula, whose name is the root of the word rabble browser. And he, as a bishop in the church, purposely went around finding and destroying Aramaic Bibles and substituting his own translations. So when you have kings, whether they pretend to be priests or whether they are sitting on a throne of a king, the tendency is to want power, to want control. And, you know, one of the things that makes people the most stupid and the most prone to living the same principles over and over and over again is keep them in hostility and fear. And you'll find that's what was done. You know, I think we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when we spoke, or recently, that, you know, at least 15 or 16 times Yeshua says, fear not, yet we have people who so often, supposedly in his name, and it's not in his name at all, say, yes, well, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God, in the name of someone who says, fear not. How does that make sense? And so many things get turned around because the weak, the hopeless, the helpless, the people who aren't willing to do their work, want to find a way to have power over others. And if you can keep them, you know, it's kind of that old barefoot and pregnant down on the farm idea.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can control them and you've got them for life.
Beginning to see the pieces through the veil.
You know, you look at, actually another good example of that is something that's going on in the culture currently. You'll notice that some people who are being proven more and more every day to be in deception have put justices on the Supreme Court who have a certain ideology, and they used deception to pass a new piece of legislation that overturned a thing called Roe versus Wade. And they call that pro-life. Now, my offering is that if we lived in a pro-life culture, there would be very little concern about abortion because we wouldn't have mothers who can't afford to feed their children. We wouldn't have fathers who are separated from their families. We wouldn't have people who go without health care. We wouldn't have, you know, we live in a country that has one of the highest rates of infant mortality and maternal mortality in the world. And we say that we're pro-life. And I challenge the pro-lifers to actually become pro-life. Let's make sure, like every other developed country in the world, every woman has proper health care. Let's make sure every woman has proper and every man has proper education. Let's make sure that we have a culture that truly has pro-life policies. It, you know, we spend, I forget exactly the numbers, but there's something like 36 or 40 developed nations that have a coalition. And we spend literally, I'm not remembering exactly the numbers, but something like 160% more than any of those other countries on so-called health care. And yet our statistics, we're at the very bottom of the ladder in health. You can't call that pro-life. So my invitation, as opposed to getting into a big argument with people about abortion, should you or shouldn't you, is what if we had a culture that was actually pro-life? Most of that conversation would be eradicated. But deception, you know, there are three, and this is just like current events, and I'm not looking from a political point of view, I'm looking from a human point of view. Three justices that made the difference that overturned Roe versus Wade and voted for it on a minute's notice. One of them was, you know, appointed just very recently. All three of them said, oh, that's settled law. We don't touch that. Life, pro-life doesn't come out of deception. And so you look at the deception that's occurred, and what you realize, another aspect of the Greek philosophical culture has taken over, is the sophists are running the world. And the word sophistry, you know, you'll notice that we've been taught that sophism is about wisdom, but actually the sophists were a group of Greek philosophers who went around Greece and for big bucks trained the children of the wealthy how to lie and make their lies look true, how to deceive people. We got three justices that lied about what they do with this particular issue. And it's got nothing to do with pro-life. It's pro-birth. But we need to take the pro-birthers and bring them into pro-life. Oh, yes, of course we're going to take mothers, of course, care of mothers' health. Of course we're going to take care of babies. Of course we're not going to have food deserts where people who don't have access to transportation can't get anywhere within the, you know, 5 miles of a grocery store where you can actually buy real food. Yeah, there's a market down on the corner that has sugar drinks and Twinkies and fried chips, but that's about it, and they call that a food store. There are food deserts in cities in this country that are just outrageous, where people who don't have access to transportation, don't have access to health care, don't have access to very much money, well, they can easily go buy a Coke, but they can't go buy a fresh apple. That's not pro-life. That's control. That's insanity. That's kings running a culture based on an agenda. And, you know, we need to get back to honoring truth, getting rid of, addressing and getting rid of the sophistry, and getting back to really, truly functioning as real human beings.
Excellent, excellent thoughts, Michael. Wow. A lot to think about there. A lot to process.
Well, that's one of the reasons we're here, is to do that, to open the space.
That's beautiful, beautiful. Jumping back to the Aramaic language, it's been really mind-opening for me, and I appreciate it. I wonder, is there any, I know that you had told us that there is pockets of areas across our earth that still speak the language?
Yes.
Other than those pockets, are there any institutions teaching the language? Is there resources available that we would want
Yes.
to look to pass on to the next generations?
Yes. There's a gentleman named Morocco Errico that I've worked with for decades. I actually haven't seen him in quite a few years now, but back in the early days of developing this work, he was actually the first person that introduced me to the Aramaic. And he has a website called Noura, NOOHRA.com, the Noura Foundation. And Rocco has a course on learning Aramaic, on actually, you know, developing the brain cells to learn the language. So you might want to check with the Neura Foundation. And there are, you know, written materials and study work for developing and understanding the Aramaic.
Excellent. N-O-O-H-R-A.
H-R-A, which means light. Yes, if I remember correctly, that's his website, Rocco
okay.
Errico. And Rocco, he used to be, he's actually in Atlanta now. I haven't talked to him, as I say, and I probably saw him the last time was 15 years ago in Atlanta. But he had a center out west. He would have me come out and speak, and I had a center in Florida, South Florida, and I'd have him come and speak. And, you know, over the years, we worked together quite a bit with, and, you know, he was the beginning of this whole engagement with the Aramaic language for me. And his translation work, and I'll have to, you know, we've got a book that we publish on what we've, or that we publish, what we published so far from the Kabur's manuscript, and I'll have to send you a copy of it. It's a three-part book that has a story about the manuscript, and then it has some select passages from the New Testament where the key words are left in Aramaic in brackets, and then in the back of the book there's a first century dictionary. I'll drop one in the mail to you so that you can have access to that, and I mean, you'll find it a gold mine. You'll love it.
Oh, that sounds excellent, excellent. Oh, the more I hear on this, I just think, how do we get this to the next generation?
Well,
wow.
the beginning point is to get it into our own minds,
mm-hmm.
and to do the work of undoing the brainwash. Our culture has become so enculturated with violence and error that we need to individually take responsibility, literally, for every stitch of hostility and fear, which is the indicator that there's corrupt data being used by the mind, take responsibility and forgive that, and then start to align ourselves with honoring truth and the willingness to look at truth and to be responsible. That's where it starts, and then, of course, passing it on to the next generation.
Mm-hmm. So what I hear in that is doing worksheets around.
That's one of the tools, yes.
Encountered.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because that's my understanding, as you know, as growing up, and, yeah, we've heard Aramaic in the religious realms, but it's like, well, we don't need any of that. We have it right here. We've got how many different translations, and just pick one and go. And
yeah, it's interesting. You know, back in the early days, traveling, doing this work, you know, before we moved here to take care of Dini's dad and our granddaughter, you know, for 40 plus years, I traveled. And one of the things that I would do is I would look for Bible stores, big, you know, large Bible stores. And I'd go in and ask for an Aramaic text. And up until the movie, The Passion of the Christ, I never went into one of the major so-called Christian bookstores that even knew what the word Aramaic was or meant. Never once did anybody ever indicate any knowledge whatsoever of it. When The Passion of the Christ came out and it was done in Aramaic, then there was a start, the beginning of an awakening. And, you know, a few times since when I've gone into a bookstore and asked, they've spoken of, well, yes, we know about it, but no, we don't have any text because it's not out there. But the thought structure, you know, when I first started to hear Rocco speaking about the Aramaic, you know, my background is in electronics with a side study in physics, and I'm listening to him, and it's like, this isn't talking about theology. This is talking about physics. You know, I'd been to medical school, and it's like, this is talking about physiology. You know, the sins of the Father, we passed the A into three and four generations, is talking about genetics. The wages of sin is death. You know, the word sin in Aramaic it does not have anything to do with some terrible, evil, awful thing we've done. It's a simple archery term. When you fired at the target and you miss the bullseye, the scorekeeper yelled sin. You're off the mark. When we engage in rage and fear and guilt and grief and blame and hatred and vengeance, we literally put creative mind energy, you know, where I started this conversation today, we put that into our physiology, and we literally create death with that. You know, you go back into those scriptures, and, you know, people want to blame God for death, but it tells us exactly what it, with man, death began. We made it up when we started to go into the mind energy of death. And so why do you expect to, before you're probably 100 years old, die? And why is everybody in your bloodline that's over 100 already dead, and mine too? Because we were taught that that's, we were given the mind energy of that's the way it works, and it's based in a lie.
And somehow it even got written in the book, 3 score and 10, right?
That's it, yes. Well, and they were describing the stage they were at that point. That's what we had degraded to. And you look at it, and we're living in a country and a world now, especially with our disease care system that is sophisticatedly called healthcare. We're living in a culture that this generation will likely have shorter lifespans than the last one for the first time in a long, long time.
Yes.
And you go back to Yeshua, look in Revelations, where he says to he or she that overcomes, they will not taste of the second death. Now, my offering is the first death is when we lose awareness of ourselves as love and buy into this false picture in our minds, and that's the self that needs to die, of something based, someone based in hostility, fear, inadequacy, I'm broken, there's something wrong with me, all the power person dynamics of the world. To overcome that, what it says, will not taste of the second death, which is my take would be, the offering would be, that's when the physiology falls apart because of the energetic patterns of death that we bought into, will not taste of that death, but will become a pillar in the temple. What is the temple? We're not talking about a church. We're talking about our temple. Do you know you are a temple of the Creator? Will become a pillar, which is a fixture, and then it says, quote, shall go out no more. That sounds like a pretty clear promise of eternal life if we do our work. But then who wants to do the work of looking at what was happening in our genes to people 50, 100, 200, 300, 500 years ago with the violence and the viciousness and the insanity that was happening? Who wants to look and who wants to feel that? Who wants to access that, face it, and process through it? Well, anybody that understands is going to go, yeah, man, I'm ready for it. But until one understands, it's like, don't make me look there. I don't want, no. I built this veil in my temple, this barrier to keep that kind of stuff unconscious. I don't want to look. I don't want to go there. Our invitation is... Go ahead.
So if we buy into the misleadings, whatever we want to call them, on the information concerning the first death, we're guaranteed the second.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
What a
and
tough
if we do our
spot.
Work, we're literally freed of it. Energy can't die. Energy is eternal.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only energy in existence. Obviously, we must be energy. Why aren't we eternal? Because we bought into sin, energies that are off the mark, hate, fear, rage, guilt, grief. And it's not that, you know, I mean, I can remember as a kid, when, oh, yeah, God's going to punish us for our sins.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Augustine that said, we're not punished by for our sins, we're punished by our sins. When we engage in an energy that doesn't belong, we put that energy into tissue. Now, this looks like punishment. There's no punishment in it. It's just, oh, the tissue, if you hit it with a hammer, is going to say, ouch, that hurts. It's not anything to do with punishment. It's the fact that that disintegrative energy is put into tissue, and tissue is giving us a warning. Hey, don't do that. Stop it. But, of course, we now have this very sophisticated culture where virtually everybody knows exactly how to blame everybody else in their world. Their whole conversation about is about who else is at fault for what's going on in their lives. And we got to give that up, and we got to start to look.
Mm-hmm.
I think I maybe mentioned a few weeks ago when we were talking the movie It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Yes.
Have you seen that movie?
No.
Have you seen it yet? Well, if you get a chance,
no.
To go online and watch it, it's really interesting because the whole bottom line to me of that movie, and it seems to be a movie about what's his name? The guy who's...
Right. Mr. Rogers?
Mr. Rogers. It seems to be a movie about Mr. Rogers, but it's actually based on a story that was written by a writer and Esquire magazine who was assigned to write a story, a 400-word story about Mr. Rogers, and he didn't want to do it, and the guy had a really lousy reputation, and his editor said, this is a story you're going to write, and he's like, I don't want to do that, and his editor says, well, you know, we tried to get you to some other people. They were doing a series. Esquire magazine was doing a live series on American heroes, and the editor said, nobody else will talk to you because you're such an ass, basically. And so he ends up, you know, sheepishly taking this assignment to write this 400-word story. And most of the rest of the movie is about how he doesn't want anything to do with Mr. Rogers because Mr. Rogers keeps inviting him to look at his life. And the basic message, I mean, there's one scene where he's got an appointment with Mr. Rogers, and Mr. Rogers starts to ask him some questions that take him back into some of his childhood dynamics, and he literally gets out of the office and walks out. And his message is, don't make me look. And that's the message of so much of the world. Don't make me look. And the actual movie is based on, I think it was something like a 16,000-word story that he wrote of the healing of himself and his family and how it liberated him from his past, his interaction with Mr. Rogers as a healer. And that's what the movie's about. It's about this guy's story and what he experienced in interacting with Mr. Rogers. Really very powerful when you have that history. And you can actually Google, if you go online, Esquire magazine, you know, It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, you'll come up with that story and you can read, you know, what this guy experienced with Mr. Rogers. It's pretty powerful. And Mr. Rogers basically was just the space, you know, inviting this guy to look. And, I mean, he literally ends up transforming his whole family. And that's what that movie's about, is the transformation of his family because of his interaction with a man that we might say was a saint, you know, in terms of a person who actually consistently, persistently just stuck to this face of love no matter what anybody else did. He's certainly a man, you know, when I saw that film and then I understood, you know, read the story and understood it, he's certainly someone I would have loved to have spent some time in his energy field. Mr. Rogers would have been pretty profound.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I'll have to look that up again. I know you brought it up. Tell me before we have to go, Michael, the movie you mentioned, The Passion of the Christ, are you referring to,
yes,
back to Ray Garcia Armaic? That's the Mel Gibson?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That one. Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me how, when you say Aramaic, I did not see it. I've read about it and things of that nature, but I've not seen the movie. What do you mean it was done in Aramaic?
When they moved away from English words, they used a mix of some Hebrew, but primarily Aramaic in the movie. You're sitting in theater and you're listening to Yeshua and the people around him, and they're speaking Aramaic. Their language is actually, the movie was done in Aramaic. Now, my understanding is that some of the translation wasn't so great, but it opened to the Western world the fact that this man Yeshua did not speak Greek or Hebrew, but spoke Aramaic, taught and thought in Aramaic, and it takes you back to the Aramaic thought system.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Thanks for that clarification. That is amazing. Mm. Yes, indeed. Guess I didn't pick up on that part. Yes.
Jeannie.
Hi.
I am not sure when. I was just doing a Google search on their website. I was actually looking for how long ago it was that we were at the synagogue, but, and I never did find it. But this other popped up, and I don't even remember putting it on the website, but it's an NPR article. It was originally in 2011, and they updated it in 2018. But it says, archaeologists unscramble the ancient graffiti in Israel. And this is what they say in the article. Of course, it's a long article, and I'm putting a link to it in today's notes. It says Aramaic is a, and I probably say this wrong, lingua franca,
the lingua
of the ancient
franca,
Middle
East. From the Middle East to the Great Wall of China. Then lingua franca just means the language of the day, like English is today.
Right. The linguistic root of modern-day Hebrew and Arabic. Once you understand Aramaic, says Karen Stern, you can read anything. You can read Hebrew. You can read Phoenician. I call it the little black dress of the Semitic languages. And then I've put the link for the where they found the graffiti in the walls of the cave and everything, and that it's Aramaic.
That is wonderful. Thank you for that information and the link that you're going to put in. That's great. Look forward to it.
And it represents a radically different way of thinking than kings and politicians want you to think.
That is something.
You go back to Yeshua.
You're almost in reverse.
That's it. It's been reversed. You hear Yeshua saying the power of life and death is in our words. And when you recognize, you know, this little flap of skin in your throat that vibrates when you supposedly say words, when you have air pass over it, creates frequency. And the universe is frequency. Words represent frequencies. There are frequencies of death, and there are frequencies of life. Hate and fear and rage and guilt and grief and pain and trauma are not frequencies of life. Life, the best definition I've been able to come up with in 50 years of doing this work, is that life is love flowing through a cell. And anything that inhibits love flowing through a cell produces death. And it primarily happens, the number one way that we have our realities structured as humans is through words. Regulatory speech, we call it in our laws of living class.
So
speech regulates physiology. Yeah, it regulates physiology. It regulates what we call chemistry. It regulates the creative process. It regulates the literal energy fields with which we join with each other to create the manifest world. And the word manifest isn't some magical word in Aramaic. The word manifest in Aramaic means obvious. The world works the way it works for you because it manifests the way it manifests for you because that's what's obvious to you. The world works differently for me because what's obvious to me is different from you. So two people start on a project and they end up in totally different places with totally different manifestations because the mind energy that each of them had and the creative process they engaged in with their mind energy produced totally different results. When we're willing to honor truth, we get to clean up our mind energy system and our past. And that's what this work's all about. Mm-hmm. Alfie. Cool. Well, we're down to the last few seconds, and the show is going to cut us off. So, Michael, to chat with you. Hope we've got space
Thank
to do
you.
It tomorrow again. And everybody, create the best year yet of your eternal lives. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.
I choose to live more consciously.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.